Before we go on the record, let me just remind everyone that we are in this courtroom at the sufferance of the Court of the Federal Circuit. And if we violate their rules, we could literally be thrown out of here, but also we lose the opportunity to use this courtroom again. So I want to remind everyone that while the attorney seated at counsel table, the witnesses and the special masters may have water in this courtroom, food or drink is otherwise prohibited. Please abide by those rules. The marshals have certainly our say-so, as well as that of the clerk for the Federal Circuit, to take you out if you don't, so, and bar you from returning. All right, with that, let's go back on the record. And Mr. Powers, would you resume begin your cross-examination?
Yeah, I'm hoping there's no federal marshal close over my shoulder. Good afternoon, Dr. Kemper. My name is Tom Powers, and along with Mr. Williams, I'm representing the Petitioner Steering Committee and both William Mead and Jordan King.
Okay.
Couple of things to ask you about from early in your testimony. You testified that neuropathology was important both to understanding the etiology of autism and to the diagnosis of autism. It was in a response to the government lawyer's question. Can you explain what neuropathological findings are currently used to diagnose autism spectrum disorder?
You mean you have to clarify that. You mean techniques?
I just mean, you're the one that testified that neuropathology was useful to diagnosing autism. And in response to a question about whether it was about...
I understand that actually wasn't the question.
That is my recollection. We can look at the transcript, but that's not an objection.
To look at, Mr. Powers. Just go ahead and ask the question, and if it's not what he said, he'll tell you that.
You were asked a question if neuropathology was helpful in both, and this is what I wrote down in quote marks, determining the etiology, it was helpful in the etiology and diagnosis of autism. So my question to you is, what neuropathological findings are used to diagnose autism spectrum disorders?
The diagnosis of autism is a clinical diagnosis, and it is not a pathological diagnosis.
So your testimony is that neuropathology is not something that would be used to diagnose autism, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. That saves me having to use the DSM-IV criteria, but I appreciate the answer.
We'll try our best.
You were also asked a question about how many actual brains of people have been used in this long series of neuropathological studies involving autism. How many?
Okay, I've got numbers here. I'll give them to you, okay? Because I know you'd ask that. our own series is 9, okay?
The Hustlers... when you say series... So you had 9 brains.
We have 9 that we've examined,
and that generated the series of papers.
That's correct.
A series of papers.
That's correct.
Okay.
Okay. The Hutzler is 8, and the Bailey is that's 6. Okay, and those are the series. There are individual case reports as well, but those are the series.
And the first series was published, 1994? Was that the first one?
The first case was of ours, it was 85.
Okay. So in the series of papers that you're talking about, there are 23 individual brains that are represented by this long series of papers by multiple authors.
That's correct.
And so that whatever findings that one would want to extrapolate from those 23 individual brains would then be what you're using to apply across the entire population of people with autism, correct?
Well, there are examples, and when they were randomly collected, there was no special reason to collect them other than the fact that they had autism.
Do you have an idea from the time that you started doing the publication of these series to the present?
Yeah.
How many people with autism are there in the United States?
Eric von Bohn is going to testify about that, but the current CDC number is 1 in 156, I believe.
So, as has been demonstrated in the past, I am not the math whiz, but okay. In a population of some 300 million people, if 1 out of 156 has autism, yeah. We would be talking about several millions of people with autism.
Okay. That's the math, yeah.
And so these 23 brains, then, that we're talking about are a sample out of many millions of people. Is that a fair statement?
Mm-hmm. And that's a yes. It's hard to when you say mm-hmm or uh-huh, it's hard when we're reading the record to
yes.
know if that's positive or negative.
Sorry. Okay.
In describing the neuropathology that you and other authors have identified here, is there anything about a living person that you can learn? See, I should actually reverse that. I'm sorry. If you look at a living person with autism, aside from doing a brain autopsy, is there any other way to get a picture of the neuropathology of that living person with autism?
Yes.
How can one do that?
With MRI scans would be one way to do it.
What are the other ways to do it?
I mean, I suppose there are ways to look at organization, with functional MRI, there's PET scans. Is that what you mean?
My question is, aside from autopsy, is there any way that one can take an autistic individual and learn the neuropathology in that individual?
Okay, I'm sorry. I understand you now. The resolution of these other techniques is such that it's very unlikely that you'd pick them up.
So it's unlikely that imaging is going to pick them up. You'd actually have to have tissue.
There's some that you do pick up, but nothing with the detail that I showed.
And the detail that you showed, this is the detail at the cellular level, correct? Purkinje's?
That's right.
Granular cells?
Sure.
These discrete sections, you would actually need tissue biopsy to get... To get that level of detail, is that
I don't
correct?
Know about biopsy, but
autopsy.
Certainly autopsy. Yeah.
Okay. So the imaging wouldn't capture it. That's all I'm trying to establish.
Yeah, I don't think so.
Okay.
I mean, they've tried, but it's not really good.
So short of autopsy, there really is not any way to look into the brain of an autistic person to get an idea of what pathology is involved, correct?
I would say so. I mean, for brain size, you can do it, but the others not, yeah.
Right. Now, brain size, that's typically going to be measured by head circumference. Is that correct?
It depends how old you are.
How does it depend? Let's explain that, please.
I'm not too sure where the age cutoff is, okay? So you can work on me on that. But in young children, you can measure it with a tape, and there's a very good correlation between head circumference and brain size. And then later in development, I'm not sure exactly where the cutoff is, it becomes unreliable.
And when you say it becomes unreliable, are you saying that head circumference is no longer a good surrogate for actually capturing the brain volume?
It's a very accurate one early on.
I understand the early on, but I just want to make sure of what we're talking about. As a person gets older,
it's less accurate. And it's very nicely laid out in the red clay and Corshane paper.
Now, there have been a series of studies done that look at head circumference and head growth patterns among children. Are you familiar with those?
Mean normal or autistic?
Well, autistic. These are the ones that you cited in your report.
Sure, yeah, of course.
And in looking at some of those studies, there's some effort to describe a general pattern and a general trajectory
of
brain growth. You recall those types of efforts?
Yes.
And then when one looks at the individual studies, that's Hazlett, which is the 2007 study that you cite in your report. Yeah. My recollection of Hazlett was that the controls and the cases, that is the autistic cases, were roughly the same until a year, and then they diverged at 12 months. Do you remember that?
No, I don't remember that detail. I use that Hazlett paper, maybe. mainly for other reasons. But I have my notes on her here if you want them.
Yeah, I'm just, I thought I brought your report up here.
Yeah. But
okay, yeah.
Okay, well, what would I say?
Well, what you say in the report, and this is on text page 4.
Okay, let me get my text page 4 here. Text page. Where is that? Text page 4, yeah, thank you.
And we're pulling it up on the screen here in just a moment, and I'm going to wait till it's up.
I got it, yeah.
There's a, on page 4, that very last full paragraph
is the paragraph. Yeah.
And excuse me, doctor, you're speaking. Wait till I ask you a question, because we're going to talk over each other, and it's going to be impossible for the record to be clear. And I'll try to do the same for you. I'll do my best not to interrupt you. So if we could highlight the last full paragraph on page 4, and the first words there are several studies have.
I've got that.
And we're going to get the highlight up for the whole paragraph.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, that just makes it easier to read. And doctor, if you see Hazlitt there, discussed initially, it says that the reported head circumference of the autistic individuals began to diverge at 12 months of age.
That's right.
So did I capture that correctly then when I said from birth to 12 months, the controls and the autistics were close together, and then they diverged at 12 months?
In this study, that's right.
In this study.
That's right.
Now then, the Dawson study, the 2006 study, which is discussed. Take a look at that.
Dawson. Okay, now where is that now? Dawson. Is that here? Oh, there it is.
If you keep reading on down in there.
Okay, I got you. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And look up after you finished reading the...
Okay. Tim. Yeah.
So what Dawson reports is actually that the differences were confined to the first 12 months.
That's what Jerry says, yeah.
So you've got one study that says they're the same in the first 12 months and then diverge, and this one says any differences are confined to the first 12 months.
That's right.
Now, if we go to Dr. Krochesny, his 2003 paper, let's take a look at that. It continues to the next page, I believe.
Yeah, that's the one that I showed here.
Right, you discussed that in your slides.
That's right, yeah.
Now, in there, he sees no statistically significant increase at 3 to 5 months, but a significant increase at 6 to 14 months.
That's correct.
And that a different result than you see in Dawson and a different result than you see in Hazlitt, correct?
That's correct.
Now, Dementeva, am I pronouncing that right? Dementeva or Dementeva?
I don't know.
Well, Dementeva is the next one. If you continue on, we're actually on page 5 of your report now.
Yeah.
Do you see that reference there to a sudden and excessive increase at
That's 1 to 2 months? Right. Yeah.
So you've got these four different studies with results that are divergent and sometimes conflicting, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Go ahead and pull that down. So the diversity in these head studies is further discussed in what is the Respondent's Exhibit 289, and this is the head circumference and height in autism study. This is Dr. Lehner, and you referred to this.
That's right. I refer to this paper.
And we've got that cover page up on the screen. Now, Susan Folstein, is she a colleague of yours?
I know her.
Okay.
Yeah, I know Susan. Yeah.
Okay. Does she work at Boston University as a neuropathologist?
No. She's not. She was at Tufts University, and now she's, I think, in Florida.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, in this study, if we look on the very front page.
Yeah.
Excuse me. That is not the page I wanted to look at. If we looked at page 16 out of 18.
Yeah, I don't have that paper in front of me now.
Okay. Oh, sorry.
Okay. Thank Yeah. 16.
And doctor, there are two different page numbers. I'll just sort of help guide you through this.
Okay.
At the very bottom, there's an exhibit stamp page number. Do you see that?
Yep.
Okay, that's what I'll refer to then instead of the text of the journal. It's page 16 of 18.
Okay. Well, this is the end of it. Okay.
And there's a heading called Implications, and we're going to go ahead and zero in on that first the first half of the paragraph on the right-hand column of the page under Implications. And what the implications of this study are that there's a very wide distribution of head circumference among people with autism, correct?
Yep.
And they say that the diversity of head circumference data reflects potentially the diversity of the clinical presentation of symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
Correct?
I'm not too sure. I don't remember the correlations with the clinical features, but you know, just off the top of my head.
Right. And we're not going to go through the tables, but what they do talk about is the increased variance of distribution, that is, of the head circumference.
Yeah, yeah.
Underscores the clinical heterogeneity of autism.
Mm-hmm.
Is that your recollection of what the study stands for?
Yeah. That was one of their conclusions.
Okay. Now, it talks about studying, in that same paragraph, the dimensional features of autism. One of the dimensional features of autism, would that include the time of onset of autism?
I don't know.
Is time a dimension?
Yes.
Would time and the progress of a disease be an important consideration in studying that disease?
Yes, of course.
Is there anything in this paper suggesting that head circumference data was collected specifically on children with regressive autism?
No.
In any of the studies that we've talked about, has there been any data collected on children specifically with regressive autism, aside from Vargas, which you had mentioned earlier?
That's... No.
In the 23 brains that you described upon which neuropathological published research is based, do any of those brains have specific information about whether the subject suffered from regressive autism or not?
No, not in the autopsy series.
There was no information about the severity of the symptoms of autism?
There is information on severity.
Okay.
Yes.
What information is there generally on the severity?
In particular, the cases of Bailey are much more severe than the others.
In Bailey or anybody else, is there any information for those particular brains about the age of onset of the symptoms?
I have not looked at those papers for that issue.
Also in that study, there's one other note I think that I wanted to run by you. No, actually, that was it. So we can put that aside.
Save
you that reading. I want to switch to the slide presentation that you were walking us through earlier.
Mm-hmm.
If we look on page, I guess this is trial exhibit 10. Is that the number that was given?
That is.
Thank you.
Oh, God. Are these all numbered here? Okay.
Yeah, I think we're at page 4. This is the template of developmental events.
Yeah. Got you.
Now, in looking at this, there's a very large scale for events that happen in the approximately 40 weeks of gestation.
That's correct.
From conception to birth. So
that's correct.
About 2/3 of the chart is related to that, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And then after birth, the only thing that's listed are as a compression of the first 4 years and a vertical line that says abnormal brain growth.
Correct.
Now, certainly you don't mean to imply by this chart that the only thing happening with brain development after birth is abnormal brain growth.
It was short so I could fit it on the page, but no, there's no question, but there's a considerable amount of brain growth. I mean, just you have to see your own child grow up.
After child is born, there's a significant amount of brain development activity. The brain is physically growing in size, correct?
No question.
Synapses are being formed, correct?
No question. Yeah.
Synapses are being pruned so that they're more functional, correct?
That's also correct.
axons and neurons are migrating through different regions of the brain to their final destinations.
Sure, and some are being eliminated.
Some pruning, not just of dendrites on a cell, but actually elimination of cells. The organization of cells is going on, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's mainly organization at that stage, yeah.
This is a process that goes on certainly through the first 2 years of life, correct?
Oh, way beyond that.
Well, that's why I said at least through the first 2 years of life.
Yeah, yeah.
And a lot of that process is mediated by glial cells, correct?
Well, they're part of it, but they're part of the process because they support the neurons. But the major thing is neurons. neurons. Yeah.
But the movement of neurons and the organization of neurons, cells such as oligodendrocytes and astrocytes play a significant role, correct?
In later brain development?
Well, I'm talking about birth to two. Are you referring to that as later brain development?
No, I just want to know what you're referring to.
Yeah, birth to two is what I'm talking about.
Okay, yeah, sure. There's a lot of development there, especially the oligodendroglial cells.
And is that with the myelin sheathing?
That's right. There's an explosion of them.
And so all of this activity does rely to a significant degree, wouldn't it be fair to say, on properly functioning glial cells and a glial network, correct?
Well, they have to function properly, yeah, of course.
And one could imagine that anything that was interfering with the normal function of glial cells during this first 2 years could affect the ultimate neuronal, not just the glial endpoints, but neuronal endpoints, correct?
I would say it's a reasonable statement.
In going to page 6...
Of what?
Oh, in your slides. Okay. We're still in your slides.
Okay. Oh, yeah.
This is a section of brain. This is, a very thin slice that you put on a slide.
Yeah.
Is this stained?
Yes.
What is it stained with?
With Nissl stain. We call it Nissl stain. It's a stain from the nerve cell bodies and the glial cell nuclei.
Okay. It's a stain. I couldn't hear the end.
I'm sorry. It stains the nerve cell bodies and the glial cell nuclei.
Okay. Can you see any glial cell nuclei in this photograph?
No, they're too small.
And is that a function of the stain or the resolution of the microscopic work?
Well, it's certainly a function of the size, but the astroglial cell you have to identify under fairly high power in order to see them. They have very specific criteria for their identification.
And what would those criteria include to identify glial cells and particularly astroglial cells?
The gold standard, and that is actually stain them with immunostains. And immunostain is called GFA, glial fibrillary acidic protein. And that's the gold standard for them, and that's the perfect way to do it.
Yeah, and that's the gold standard because it's immune reactive, correct?
And only with astroglial cells.
Right.
Yeah.
And so it doesn't stain the neurons because it wouldn't have the immune cells on the surface that would attract the stain.
And it wouldn't stain the other species of glial cells either.
Right. So in the slides that you have here on page, I wanted to ask on page 8, is this one of your slides or a collection of your slides?
I'll look and see. Yes,
these
it
are
is.
The inferior olive.
Yes, that's ours.
Was GFAP used in any of these?
No, these brains, our own brains, are embedded in a substance called psilocybin, and it does not allow for immunostains.
So the pathological slides that you've been referring to here, none of the ones that are your slides involve GFAP staining?
That's correct.
And they were not at a resolution that would pick up the astroglial cells, correct?
Not at these.
Okay. And I was curious because as I went through here, there was a lot of talk of neurons, but I didn't hear any discussion of glial cells in the imaging.
Yeah, the pretty much what's known about, in proper science, pretty much what's known about the glial cells is in that Vargas paper. They're not, if you read our papers, we've said very little about them. because we didn't want to make mistakes or say something was wrong, you know.
And he didn't say very much about it, because it sounds like from just the basic workup of the tissue, in a lot of ways you couldn't even look for it. Even if you wanted to, given the condition the tissue was in and how it was preserved, you couldn't have done the work, right?
Right.
Right.
Agree with you.
On page 9,
yeah,
and we're still in Exhibit 10, which is your collection of slides here. These are the Purkinje cells. There was some mention that you made of GABAergic.
GABAergic.
GABAergic, thank you. What's a GABAergic neuron?
It's an inhibitory neuron. That's the main inhibitory transmitter in the brain.
And are Purkinje cells GABAergic?
Yes, they are.
So Purkinje cells would be cells that would excrete the neurotransmitter GABA, which inhibits.
That's correct.
Okay. So that's the main inhibitory neurotransmitter in the brain, correct?
That's correct.
Is it sort of the flip side of the glutamate coin?
Yep.
And so if there is excess glutamate, GABAergic cells such as Purkinje cells would be secreting GABA to maintain homeostasis, so to speak.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
You'll have to rephrase that because I'm not too sure I followed you.
Okay. If there was an excessive level of glutamate in the brain, at any one time.
Okay, for any reason. Okay, yeah.
For any reason.
Okay, yeah.
The feedback, the response from the Purkinje cells would be to release GABA to inhibit and bring homeostasis
in
back.
Balance, huh? Yeah, I don't know in particular whether the Purkinje cells would do that. You know, that I don't. but the brain is filled with GABAergic neurons. It doesn't have to be that one.
but Purkinje cells are among the GABAergic.
That's correct.
Okay. Are there other cells that are not neurons that also release GABA and are GABAergic?
They're not neurons?
Correct.
I don't know of anything other than neurons.
Are there any forms of astrocyte that release GABA into the extracellular space in the brain?
That's not in my expertise, and I really can't say that, but I don't think so.
And I wanted to make sure, again, just to moving through the slides, I suspect the answer, but I want to confirm it. If we look at the imaging on slide 12, the inferior olive in childhood, and on 13.
Yeah.
All of these inferior olive images are from your lab?
That's correct.
Okay. Okay. And I ask because there's, on most of these pages, there's a citation to whatever paper.
That's right. Yeah.
It's page 16 and page 17. Are those images also from your lab?
That's correct.
And are these all from those same 9 brains originally?
No. We have a lot of studies going on in the lab using immunostains and other approaches to looking at the anatomy of autism. And I do the neuropathology for some of these studies. And this is found on one of those. These are found on those brains. These are frozen sections.
Okay. But again, so this is not published in a paper anywhere. This is just stuff from your lab?
That's right. They're just nice examples. And the cells in the white matter are shown by several other people. It wasn't just, me.
Now, in the slides, and don't put it aside yet.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
In the slides that you were just looking at, these the unpublished case control ones, in the staining on those slides, did you do any of the immunohistochemical analysis to identify glial cells?
No. These are all done for neurotransmitters.
So these were slides that are done to look at the presence of what particular neurotransmitters?
We're mainly interested in the GABAergic system.
Okay. Was there any look in your work here that's represented in the slides involving glutamate?
Matter of fact, before I left to come here, I checked with the people because I knew that somebody would ask that question. And there's nothing ready to publish on the glutamate. the only possibility is the, I'm not sure it's published or not, is the increase in NMDA receptors in the granule cell layer of the hippocampus. Decrease.
In any of the work that you've done in your lab, published or unpublished, have you ever looked for neuroinflammation in the brains of autistic people?
No. No.
Now let's talk a little bit about the Vargas, sure. the work that Drs. Vargas and Pardo are doing. There's been discussion of a letter that was given to us at the beginning of the hearing. And this is, was it LL?
LL.
Okay, this is Respondents Exhibit LL. And do you have a copy of that letter in front of you, Doctor?
Yes, I do. I'm sorry.
Thank you. I was assuming you might, because I first off noticed that it is addressed to you. This is not anything that was addressed to the Department of Health and Human Services or the Department of Justice.
That's correct.
This is personal correspondence between Dr. Pardo and yourself.
I presume so.
Okay. Yeah. I'm just waiting for the yes answer, so again, we can have that on the record. You got to give a full word answer. Now, this letter is dated May 13th, but it addresses a conversation that you had last year with
Dr. Pardo. That's correct.
Now, in reading Dr. Pardo's, it was actually Dr. Vargas's paper.
Yeah.
One that's entitled Neuroglial Activation and Neuroinflammation in the Brains of Patients with Autism.
Yeah.
And we're going to go ahead and give you a copy of that so you have it on the desk.
I've got the Vargas paper here. You want me?
Yeah, you're collecting some paper over there. This is Petitioner's Master Reference 69.
Thank you.
And the first thing, well, we're going to put that up on the screen.
Okay, let me just...
We're going to replace the letter. Okay. Is what you see on the screen there, Doctor?
Yes, I see it.
Does that reflect the paper exhibit you have in your hand?
Yes, it does.
Okay, so we're all looking at the same thing. I'm going to direct your attention to page 13 of the exhibit.
13, okay. Who's 13? I see.
Where it says page 13 of 15 at the bottom.
Okay.
Okay, we're going to look at the top left-hand corner of this paper,
yeah.
And there's a sentence that begins, "These observations do not support."
Yes, okay.
We're going to blow that up, and we're going to highlight that right up through where it has footnote 11.
Mm-hmm.
You see that?
Yep.
Okay, so what the authors say is that the observations they made
yeah.
don't support the previously proposed hypothesis that changes in the cerebellum in autism result solely from developmental abnormalities
yeah.
in olivary cerebellar circuits
yeah.
and a reduced number of Purkinje cells.
Yeah.
Obviously, I was just reading that from the paper, but that's what it says.
No, fine.
And then if one turns to footnote 11.
11? I'm sorry, what did you say?
There's a citation there to a paper.
Oh, yeah.
And it's paper number 11, which is on page 14 of 15.
Yeah, that's ours. That's right. That's correct.
That's your paper.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah.
So when this paper came out, the authors were saying, our results are not consistent with this work that Dr. Kemper and Dr. Bowman are engaged in.
That's right.
Was it after this paper came out that you had a conversation with these folks and said...
No.
How did the conversation come about?
When he had, he was at a meeting that I was attending. That's the setting for it, and he'd had this wonderful paper here about the neuroinflammatory response, neuroinflammatory response, and I was just curious as to what he thought about all of the problems we found, the developmental problems in the autistic brains and how he felt it fit in. That was the substance of the conversation. It wasn't this issue.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it was more of a general conversation of two scientists talking about their work overlap.
Yeah, it was an interesting new concept, and I wanted to discuss it with the guy that was a key player in it.
Mm-hmm. Now, if you go a little bit further down on page 13 of 15.
Yeah.
If we look on the left-hand column, just about halfway down the page, there's a sentence that begins, the presence of MCP1.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I see that.
Okay. And we're going to highlight that whole sentence, the presence of MCP1, because it talks about it facilitates the infiltration and accumulation of monocytes and macrophages in inflammatory central nervous system disease. Correct?
I'm not a neuroimmunologist. I really couldn't speak from my own knowledge about that. I only know what's here.
Right. But what it does say here is that the neuroimmunologist thought it significant because this particular pro-inflammatory cytokine facilitated the infiltration and accumulation of monocytes and macrophages in CNS disease, correct?
If that's what they say, fine, yeah.
Monocytes and macrophages are immune cells, correct?
Yeah, they're part of the adaptive immune system.
Right.
Yeah.
And they infiltrate into this inflamed area of the brain because of the presence of the MPC1, correct?
If that's what they say, as I say, I can't really answer that from my own knowledge.
Okay. Yeah. We're also then going to shift over to the right-hand side of that page. Okay. In the second full paragraph, there's a sentence that begins, importantly, cells undergoing cell death.
Just a minute. I see that.
I'm going to take a moment to highlight it here on the screen.
Okay.
Importantly, and let's go all the way down to the sentence that begins both pro-inflammatory. Just take it all the way down there. Keep going. There you go. Now, this substance that's being talked about here, TGF-beta-1.
Yeah.
Do you have an understanding of what that is?
Only what's here. I really have no personal involvement with any of these.
Well, would you trust me if I told you it was transferring growth factor, beta-1?
Yeah, I know the name, yeah.
Okay, and it's an anti-inflammatory cytokine,
that's
correct?
That's my understanding of it, yeah.
And the paper says that's the primary anti-inflammatory cytokine that was found in these samples, right?
Okay.
The argument has been made, and I think it was even expressed in your direct, that there are protective pro-inflammatory cytokines released. And you are relying on this paper for support of that proposition, correct?
Yes.
Now, the authors of the paper do note that TGF-1, while it is an anti-inflammatory, as it says, it is actually released by cells that are dying.
Mm-hmm.
Correct?
That I don't know.
Well, I mean, it says it in the paper. Importantly, cells undergoing cell death have been shown to secrete TGF.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay.
And that they secrete it to protect bystander cells, correct?
I've got the same answer I gave before.
So, but your understanding then is if you have this anti-inflammatory cytokine going on, while it may be protective of some cells, it's actually evidence that adjoining cells have recently died, correct?
That's what they say. I don't know.
We're going to go on in this paper to page 14 again, page 14 of 15. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the left-hand column, the first part of the section beginning the conclusion, the authors here conclude that the neuroglial reactions, and first off, neuroglial describes both the microglial observed reactions and the astroglial reactions.
That's my understanding, yes.
So they're talking about two different groups of glial cells that they found were activated in these brains, correct?
That's my understanding, yes.
Okay. So that this neuroglial reaction, we've been talking a lot about, or you've been talking a lot about astrocytes, this neuroglial reaction also involves the microglia, correct?
That's correct.
And the microglia are the cells that are sort of, we've heard described as the macrophages of the brain. The brain's innate immune system.
Yeah, and they have other functions too.
Exactly.
Yeah,
but in terms of the immune response, the microglial cells, in response to an antigen, a virus, something like that, will react to eliminate the invader, so to speak.
Well, they're part of the reaction, yeah.
So in the mechanism they describe, they say that there are important mechanisms associated with neural dysfunction and autism, and that the cerebellum is the focus of an active and chronic neuroinflammatory process in autistic patients.
Yeah.
That's what they conclude in the conclusion section.
Yeah, that's right.
Now, they don't ascribe a particular cause at that point to this neuroinflammatory process.
No.
They don't say that this is a neuroinflammatory process that's limited to earlier pathological conditions of these patients, do they?
Well, that's one of the possibilities. That's right.
One of the possibilities is, as you testified, that the neuroinflammation is related to the pathology that exists that was essentially prenatal in its origin, correct?
I'm not sure is or can.
Well, that's what I'm trying to get at.
That's right.
It can be, but it is not necessarily so. Correct?
As I told you before several times, I'm not an expert on this stuff, and I don't really. What I know is what's in Pardo's letter, you know, and here.
Well, I understand that, but you are asked questions specifically asking what your understanding and your opinion was, having reviewed the studies in the letter.
It is my opinion.
So your opinion is that one of the possibilities of this neuroinflammation. Let me finish the question.
Sure.
Not to be snippy, but
we've got to keep
a record. One of the possible explanations for this neuroinflammatory process that they describe as active ongoing, one of the causes is pathology that has its origins prenatally, correct?
I would say likely.
It is also possible that this inflammatory process reflects events that happened postnatally.
I suppose so.
It's also possible that these neuroinflammatory processes reflect a response to a toxin or other environmental exogenous factor that could have triggered the neuroinflammatory process. That's a possibility.
Well, they actually state there that they don't think that this response could be due to an exogenous toxin, so I would just take their word.
Where do they state that?
Okay, just a minute. Let me just find that.
I'm just curious as to where.
I think so.
Oh,
I know you would be curious. Sure, where I got that then. Thank you. I don't see it here, sir. Yeah.
So there's nothing in the peer-reviewed published paper that rules out possible environmental toxins as a cause of the observed neuroinflammatory process, is there?
I'd have to read it again with that thought in mind.
And what you just read was Dr. Pardo's letter, and there was
That's correct.
In that letter ruling it out, was there, correct?
I didn't see it, yeah.
In fact, if we turn to Exhibit 72, which is another paper that Dr. Pardo and Dr. Vargas are the authors of.
This would be Petitioner's Master List 72 rather than Exhibit 72.
Master Reference List number 72. This is the lead author on this one is Dr. Pardo.
Yeah.
Do you have a paper copy there, Doctor?
Yes, I do.
Okay. And take a look at the screen. Make sure, again, we're looking at the same document.
Yep.
Okay. Let's go ahead and turn to page 9 of 12. This is the exhibit page.
Oh, I don't know.
Yeah, it's right, okay. Yeah, right there.
I don't have a one of your copies. But I've got it here. That's the one with the diagram.
It's the one with the diagram, yeah. We're going to look at a couple of things here. Let's look at the text under conclusion.
Okay.
And you see that's highlighted.
We hypothesize. Okay.
Now, if you take a look at that sentence, Dr. Pardo here is hypothesizing that environmental factors in the presence of genetic susceptibility and the immunogenetic background of the host influence the development of these abnormalities that they observed, correct?
That's what it says.
And it also attributes this hypothesis of environmental factors specifically to the neuroinflammatory changes responsible for the generation of autistic symptoms, correct?
And the changes responsible for the generation of,
So not only does Dr. Pardo's letter not rule it out, it's specifically advanced as a hypothesis in the published paper.
Responsible for the generation. Let me read this again. This generation of the autoptic symptoms in that sentence refers to the neural circuitry.
And the neuroinflammatory changes.
Yeah.
So they hypothesize that environmental factors could play a role.
Yeah.
In fact, if you look at the chart that's up at the top left-hand column, let's go ahead and focus on that. This is figure 4 on page 9 in Petitioner's Master Reference 72. Mm-hmm. There's actually a chart there that it includes environmental factors in the development of what is generated at the bottom right hand there, which is the autistic phenotype, correct?
Yes.
Was that a yes?
Yes.
And that under environment, toxins specifically are mentioned, correct?
Now let me just look at this and toxins under environment. That's right.
And then under autistic phenotype, regression is specifically listed, correct?
Yeah. Yes.
So this paper does postulate a hypothetical role for environmental exposures in creating neuroinflammation that ultimately leads to the regressive phenotype of autism, correct?
Yeah, that can be an interpretation of this, yeah.
Okay, I have no further questions.
Okay, thank you.
Redirect.
Dr. Kemper, you were asked some questions during cross-examination about brain development during the first 2 years of life. Do you remember those questions?
Yes, I do.
And you were asked some questions about the role of microglia and astrocytes and the development of the brain. Do you remember those questions?
Yes, I do.
Okay. First of all, I want to ask you, are you aware of any evidence that thimerosal from vaccines affects that process of brain development?
I'm not aware of any evidence of that.
And you've reviewed Dr. Kinsborn's report,
yes,
correct?
I have.
Is that process of brain development Dr. Kinsborn's hypothesis for how thimerosal-containing vaccines cause autism?
I'm sorry, you have to... It's too complicated a question.
Is the process that you were being asked questions about involving microglia and astrocytes and their role in developing the brain,
yeah.
Is that what Dr. Kinsborn is saying is causing autism as a result of exposure to thimerosal?
Not to my understanding.
You were asked a series of questions about the your own work and the brains that you've looked at.
Correct.
First of all, can you just describe a little bit about how you look at slides and what that process entails?
You mean in terms of the
process from when you get a brain sample and how you go about looking at the samples from that, collecting the samples?
Well, you know, if it's an autopsy, we describe the brain and we take blocks from it. And then it goes to the lab and they process the tissues. Then we get back the sections with whatever stains we think are necessary. And we look at them and figure out what we think is going on, describe it, and then draw a conclusion.
And how much of the brain do you look at?
Well, maybe four or five blocks from a brain where there's no complicated processes at all.
And how long does it take you to look at a single section of the brain?
10, 15 minutes maybe.
Okay. Yeah. But the process of looking at these, is this a meticulous process?
It depends on the nature of the change. If it's a complicated problem, it just goes on for a long time.
So you were asked some questions about whether you looked personally for neuroinflammation in the samples that you studied. Mm-hmm. You remember that question?
Yeah.
And you testified that you did not look for neuroinflammation. That's not been the focus of your research, is that right?
Well, yeah, those responses are not really readily seen with our material.
Okay, but the Vargas group, they did look for neuroinflammation.
Oh, with proper stains, yeah.
Okay, and they found in their studies that the astrocyte activity was increased in their samples, correct?
Yeah, they're activated, yeah.
And that is not, again, consistent with Dr. Kinsborn's hypothesis.
That's
in
correct,
this case,
yeah.
Is that right? You're asked a series of questions about the Vargas research and Dr. Pardo's letter. Dr. Kemper, is Dr. Pardo, on the Vargas article, is Dr. Pardo the senior researcher on that study?
That's my understanding.
Okay. And I believe you mentioned that you, when during your conversation with Dr. Pardo about a year ago at the meeting you were at, that did he say to you that he didn't think that it was a neurotoxin that was causing the neuroinflammation?
It could easily have been at that time, as I know I did hear it from him.
Okay. And I think you said that you had read it somewhere, and I want to pull up the letter that he sent you.
Okay.
And this is, again, his Respondents Exhibit LL.
Yeah.
And if you look at the second paragraph on the first page of his letter,
okay,
it's the highlighted portion that we're pulling up on the screen.
I got this right here. Yeah.
And this is where Dr. Pardo is talking about staining that they did and said that these findings are inconsistent with the hypothesis of a potential toxic effect on astrocytes by neurotoxins or toxic material. Do you think that's what you were referring to when you said that you had read it somewhere?
These findings are consistent with the hypothesis of a potential toxic effect on astrocytes in sedentia. Yeah.
All right, do you think that could be what you were referring to when you said that you had read that somewhere before?
Yeah.
Is that a yes?
Yes, I'm sorry.
And and during your conversation with Dr. Pardo, did you also discuss whether the findings of neuroinflammation could be consistent with a response to abnormal development?
Yes.
And is that conversation, is that reflected in the letter that Dr. Pardo has sent?
Yes, it is.
To you and submitted. And in your opinion, and based on your almost three decades now of experience researching the neuropathology of autism, do you believe it is more likely that neuroinflammation is a response to developmental abnormalities that occur prenatally?
Yes, I do.
Thank you. I have nothing further.
Russ?
Yes, Special Master. That sentence that you just read from the letter, the one that was this is confirmed by, the final sentence says that these findings are inconsistent with the hypothesis of a potential toxic effect on astrocytes by neurotoxins or toxic material,
that's right,
correct?
That's right. Yep, yes.
There's nothing in this sentence that says that the astrocytes were unaffected by pro-inflammatory cytokines released by microglia, correct?
No, not in that sentence.
There's nothing in the sentence that says that the astrocytes were unaffected by reactive oxygen species released by activated microglia.
There's no mention here at all.
Excuse me?
There's no mention here at all of reactive oxygen species.
So this just talks about the direct toxic effect on the astrocytes of toxic material and neurotoxins, correct?
Well, it's getting complicated for me now.
Well, let me back up then. Let me ask the question this way.
Please do, yeah.
The neuroinflammatory process, we discussed this on my initial cross, involves both microglia and astrocytes, correct?
That's correct.
So the neuroinflammatory process generally can be triggered by neurotoxins or toxic material, at least to the extent that the microglia are involved, correct?
I suppose so, yeah.
And the microglia, if they are activated and if they proliferate, they release reactive oxygen species, and they release pro-inflammatory cytokines, correct?
I really can't respond to that because it's not part of my information.
Well, let me ask you if you know this. If reactive oxygen species and pro-inflammatory cytokines that are released in an inflammatory process contact astrocytes, can they impair the function of astrocytes or kill astrocytes?
I have the same answer. I really can't respond to that because it's not part of my information.
And speaking of the information that we're using here, I want to talk a couple of things. Now, as a scientist, what you would rely on the most, I assume, is peer-reviewed, published scientific literature, correct?
That's correct.
So as a scientist reaching conclusions about science, something that is in a peer-reviewed journal article is going to carry the most amount of weight, correct?
It carries more weight, for sure.
And if it's in a really good journal by a really good author, it carries even more weight.
Obviously, yeah.
Now, if you are engaged in a scientific inquiry and we're looking at non-peer-reviewed, non-published material, including personal correspondence from one scientist to another, which do you think would be more reliable?
I would have to depend on my opinion of the scientist, really.
So,
I mean, if I was publishing it, then it'd be something different. But
we're talking about a disinterested observer resolving scientific facts.
Yeah.
What would you rely on more, personal correspondence between people or peer-reviewed, published scientific journal articles?
Well, the latter.
No further questions.
Questions? Apparently, neither my colleagues nor I have any questions for Dr. Kemper. So, Doctor, you're excused. And we are now at not quite 3:30. I wonder if it is possible we have Dr. Rodier as the first person on our list for tomorrow. If we might get through her qualifications at least today, that is her background publications, before we get into the substance of her testimony, and then take up the substance tomorrow morning. Petitioners look like they concur.
You would stipulate the qualification. I mean, whatever the special masters and respondent want to do, but we're prepared to sit through that part without any objection.
Special Master, I don't think there would be a problem doing that. I'm not sure that tomorrow is going to necessarily be a day that we need to. I think we'll.
Tomorrow's going to be a short day anyway.
I don't think we're going to be running up against 5 o'clock tomorrow, though I'm not certain how long Dr. Goodman would go. I don't think we would be pressed to get done tomorrow
No difficulty with continuing today, it may be more appropriate to continue today. Given that tomorrow is the start of a holiday weekend and some people drive some distances,
I understand, ma'am. I guess I was just thinking of our trial team. It's not a three-day weekend for them. They'll be working.
Well, most of us, I think, are taking things home with us as well.
I understand from Mr. Johnson, who will be doing the direct examination of Dr. Rodier, if she's available, if she's ready, he'd be ready to go through her qualifications.
And that would at least take us a little further along the path.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Okay. All right. Well, then, Dr. Kemper, thank you very much for your testimony. You're excused. And we'll have...
These are yours, I think.
Yeah. Do you need a brief recess before we begin with Dr. Rodier, or do you want to just push on?
We can...
I think we can just go right on to Dr. Rodier.
Yours.
Special Master, we may have to follow up with a few questions tomorrow on qualifications.
We certainly understand.
Mr. Johnson has prepared that, but he doesn't have it with him, so
okay.
He's going to do his best from memory.
And hope that your qualifications match up similarly to Dr. Kemper's, which I'm sure they do. So we'll just go off of his questions.
All right. Dr. Rodier, would you raise your right hand, please? You swear or affirm that the evidence you should give in the case now in hearing should be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth of God?
I do.
Thank you.
Dr. Rodier, could you please state your full name for the record?
Patricia M. Rodier.
And Dr. Rodier, where do you currently work?
I'm at the University of Rochester Medical Center in Rochester, New York.
And what position do you hold at the University of Rochester?
I'm professor of OBGYN.
Could you briefly describe your educational background and employment history leading up to your current position, starting with your college degree?
Okay. I got my AB from Sweetbriar College in Virginia, where I'm from, and then went to the University of Virginia for my PhD in experimental psychology. After that, I did a postdoc in the medical school, working in the field of embryology and teratology.
And what did you do after that?
After that, I stayed on the faculty of the medical school for about 10 years.
You mentioned teratology, and we've heard some testimony about that earlier in the trial. I was wondering if you could just explain what teratology is.
Sure. I think everyone's heard of toxicology, and you've had a number of toxicologists testify. Teratologists are toxicologists who specialize in the developing animal or human. And so, in fact, in just the last few years, we changed the name of the journal Teratology to Birth Defects Research. So they're experts on birth defects.
And that's closely tied to development, is that accurate?
Yes.
What responsibilities do you have in your current position?
For over 20 years, I've been about 100% funded by NIH, and so I don't have much in the way of teaching duties or administrative duties. I'm just mainly full-time research.
And what have some of your research interests been over the years?
Always, I've been interested in the development of the nervous system, and how anything that interferes with it might alter it so that you get aberrant behavior. Since my PhD was in psychology, of course, I have an interest in behavior. So initially, I was interested in things like learning disabilities and was interested in very basic approaches to trying to figure out how the nervous system changed over time and how that influenced the outcome of injuries. And so I worked with some sort of classic teratogens, like 5-acetylcytidine and 5-fluorouracil. And these are actually things that at the time were being thought of as possible chemotherapy agents. And they're things that are known to interfere with development very directly. And by doing that, I developed a sense of and a lot of papers on what difference it makes when an injury occurs at one time versus another in development.
And have you published any articles or text on your research?
Yes.
And do you have an idea as to approximately how many publications you
have? I'm not really sure. I would say it's probably like 60 or 70.
Okay. And are you a member of any professional organizations?
MFAR and the Teratology Society, the Neuroteratology Society, are organizations I've been a member of.
And are you board certified in any areas?
No, I'm not a physician.
Okay. And so the board certification is not required?
Right.
And are you a reviewer for any journals?
Lots.
Okay. Can you name a few?
I'm Neuroteratology and Toxicology. I'm on the editorial board, and I've served as the president of the editorial board of Teratology. But I also review for autism and developmental disabilities, developmental psychobiology, medical genetics, biological psychiatry, many different journals.
And do you, in your research and the work that you've done, have you had any, I don't want to say exposure to mercury, but any experience working with mercury?
Yes. When I moved to the University of Rochester in 1980, which is a big center for studies of mercury in the toxicology department, I became interested in why the unborn child was so much more sensitive to methylmercury ingested by the mother than the mother herself. And this was well known from the accidents in Iraq. And so I set out with a graduate student to try to figure out why that was, and we immediately discovered something.
And what did you discover?
That methylmercury causes arrest of cells in mitosis. And it, you know how when cells are dividing, they sort of round up and they almost look like they have a star in them, and that's called starry metaphase. And then in the next set of the part of the process, those starry lines, which are chromosomes, start to pull apart, and you see something that looks like this, and then you see the two cells split in between. And there are drugs that do that. Colchicine is the main one. And we were amazed to see that was what was happening in our developing brains. We could see starry metaphases everywhere. And then when we held the animals longer and counted the number of neurons, we had reductions in the number of neurons. And see, that process isn't going on to any great extent in the brain of adults. And so that explains the greater sensitivity.
And are those findings, have they been published?
Oh, yes.
Dr. Rohde, I'm going to stop you. You were holding your hands with the fingers pointing towards one another, sort of in a cupped or circular fashion, and then you started pulling them apart mm-hmm. when you were saying, it looks like this. Is that correct?
That is how it looks.
Okay. Yeah.
If I had a pen, I could draw you a picture.
Maybe we'll give you one tomorrow.
Right. Now, Dr. Rohde, you also have experience in the field of autism as well, correct?
That's right.
How did you become interested in the field of autism?
Because of my work on brain damage, I've often been invited to speak for groups like the Learning Disabilities Association. And I was giving a talk at a meeting a number of years ago, and a parent came up to me, the parent of an autistic child, and said, you know, I think that those of you who work on development really have something to offer to this field, because no one from development has ever looked at autism. And at first I thought, well, that can't be true. But then I thought, no, I think I know everybody in development of the nervous system, and they haven't. So I offered to go home and do some reading for him. I went home and read about 200 papers in a couple of weeks. And he was right. No one who works on development had ever worked in autism. And so I definitely became interested, but in my review of the literature, I couldn't see enough biological information that someone with my skills could think of a way to introduce those to the field. And it was only later that year that I heard of the discovery of the thalidomide cases with autism, and that made me realize how a teratologist could, in fact, work on autism.
And do you remember approximately what year that was?
It was 83 or 84.
And since that time, you've had an interest in autism?
Definitely.
And you've published, have you published on, and specifically on the issue of autism?
Mm-hmm.
Can you describe some of those publications?
Well, one Dr. Kemper mentioned, I'm interested in neuroanatomy, of course. And
if you're going to discuss any of these tomorrow, you don't have to describe them
right.
in detail. But
excuse me. We've also looked at developing an animal model of autism. And some of the discussion here has gone into the fact that some of the animal model work has not used behaviors in animals that can be shown to have anything to do with the behaviors in autism. But in fact, we've worked at developing some behaviors, showing that they're different in human cases, and then taking them into animals that are behaviors that can be done exactly the same in different species. And one of those is eye blink conditioning. So there are some behaviors. They're not the kinds of behaviors that are used in diagnosis. They're more neurophysiological measures. But we've been trying to look for ones that might be good parallels between species.
And you mentioned eye blink conditioning. Could you explain what that is?
It's Pavlovian conditioning. You remember that Pavlov would ring a bell and give his dogs meat powder, and after he rang the bell and gave them the meat powder over and over, he would ring the bell and they would salivate without the meat powder. And in eye blink conditioning, what you're doing is delivering a little puff of air to the eye after a tone comes on, and the child or the adult, whoever, blinks in response to the puff of air. And after many repetitions, they come to blink before the puff of air so that they protect the eye. And this is it's a wonderful measure because it's an unconscious process. It requires no instructions. With adults, you usually do it while they're reading a book or a magazine. With our kids, we do it while they watch Shrek. And so they're paying total attention to the movie, are not conscious of the air puffs or the tones, but they quickly become conditioned, we call it. They learn to blink following the tone.
And this is a study that's currently ongoing in your clinic?
We've had studies going on actually at two sites with this, human ones at our place and animal ones in Delaware.
And the goal of this study is to come up with an animal model. For what purpose?
Well, we've developed the animal model, and we've already done its neuroanatomy. But what we've done now is we have been able to show that these animals do have this oddity of eye blink, and that we see in human cases. So that's a parallelism that suggests that it really is a good model. So now what we'd like to do is take that knowledge and look at some of the other animal models to see if they are parallel to the human condition.
So, Professors, I think that's about
as far as you're going to go today. Right. All right, fair enough. Then I think we'll go ahead and excuse you for the day, Dr. Rodier. We'll go off the record. We're in recess until tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. All right. Council, I understand there was a matter that we needed to talk about.
I think a couple of things, Special.
Okay.
Thank you.